Bit about Sefer Dvarim, about Parshas Dvarim, but really Sefer Dvarim, because this week we begin Sefer Dvarim, and there are lots of challenges trying to understand Sefer Dvarim. Sefer Dvarim is clearly, obviously, stylistically, entirely different than the other Svarim, and in terms of message, in terms of what it's all about. And one of the challenges that the Rishonim deal with is trying to pinpoint exactly what the topic is of Sefer Dvarim. There's Musar, there are new mitzvos, there are old mitzvos repeated, there's Tochacha, there's Tshuva. What exactly is the unifying theme of Sefer Dvarim? And whatever that theme may be, the fact is that Hashkacha has it that we always read Parshas Dvarim, we always begin Sefer Dvarim right before Tisha B'Av. And that's not by accident. In fact, in case we were to be confused and think that it's just coincidence, some of the Rishonim developed mnemonics in order to associate the reading of the Parsha with the time of the year. How the Eschanan has to be Shabbos Nachmu, how Devarim has to be associated with Tisha B'Av, because there is some link between them. The question, of course, is what exactly is that link? So perhaps, maybe, one can suggest that the theme of Sefer Dvarim is how to deal with the ups and downs of life, how to deal with what seems to us to be failure in many points in our life. In the rest of the Torah, we're taught about mitzvos and rules that we have to live our lives by. A very high standard is set. It's tarryag mitzvos, so you got to live up to it. You have to do everything. We're taught of the great history of our people. A very high standard is set. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Not easy to live up to those examples, you know, to live up to that yichus. Last night I was in Marashah and a boy came over to me and said to me after my shir, Rabbi, I just wanted you to give me a bracha. I'm like, you may have confused me with the Redzinners in Kaylee. You may have confused me with someone else. So I asked him his name, and he told me his name. I said, wow, I said to one of the Rebbeim there, this boy's great-grandfather learned Bechavrusa with Rav Elchanan Wasserman for 4 years. You know what kind of yichus he has? And I felt bad as soon as I said it, because probably he doesn't want the weight of all of that right now. At this, he'll enjoy it sometime, but right now, the weight of all of that, it's a lot to live up to an Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's a lot of pressure. And of course, we're going to fail on some level, you know, at some points. And whether it be the standard of just keeping all the Taryag mitzvos, or the standard of living up to these great examples of the Avos and the Imahos, Devarim introduces us to the long story of Jewish history, to the ups and the downs, sort of in a condensed form. Devarim tells us that, you know, things weren't always great. There are a lot of times that we failed, that we did things that we should not have done. And up until this point, Moshe always spoke in third person. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lema. I mean, it's not Moshe speaking, it's the Torah speaking. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lema. Now, it changes to first person. Vayomer Hashem elai. Hashem spoke to me. It's as if Moshe, ki'ilu, were pulling up a chair, looking us in the eye, and having a personal conversation with us, except, of course, the fact that every single word is divine, just like the rest of the Torah, where every single word is divine. But the style changes a little bit. It's like a conversation where Moshe is trying to give us chizik. And the conversation comes at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu's greatest failure. His greatest failure. What's his greatest failure? It's his inability to enter Eretz Yisrael. That's what it's all about. All the 40 years, everything he did was all about leading to this point. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't be the one to bring us into Eretz Yisrael. It's a time where a lesser person would look back at his life and just feel dejected, give up, say, oh, all of it was for nothing. All of it was a waste. But it's precisely at that time that Moshe tells us what it's going to be like to live life like a Jew. There have been failures, there will be more failures. There will be times we don't understand what Hashem is doing to us. There are times we're going to fall way short of what we ought to be doing for Hashem. But in those times that it feels like we're moving backwards, or it feels like we're not moving at all, we have to find the insight and the strength to celebrate small successes, to continue our life's mission, because in the long run, we have to realize Klal Yisrael is always in an upward and onward trajectory. Meaning, even though it could be that there are failures along the way, that seeing big picture, seeing broad view, we're getting closer and closer to Mashiach, we're getting closer and closer to Geula, even as we suffer from a number of setbacks. So at the very time that Moshe recalls our failures, he reminds us of sampling of our mitzvahs, our responsibilities in life. It's not a time to give up. You know, a person gets depressed, just stays in bed all day. No, not a time to do that. We have to work. We have a job to do. And it teaches us new mitzvahs, because life will go on and there will always be new challenges. There will be new things to do. And there have been many Jews who must have felt at some point in their life that they had failed and that they hadn't advanced the cause of the Jewish people, but didn't even realize, you know, how much they actually accomplished. Moshe may not have realized his personal mission, but he gave us the Torah and he brought us to the doorstep of Eretz Yisrael, and he left us in the hands of a capable leader who he himself had trained. Moshe's contribution to the Jewish people, you know, as much as he may have felt like he failed at some point, his contribution to the Jewish people has yet to be matched by anybody, obviously, and it's not even close. Right? Nobody has duplicated what Moshe Rabbeinu has done. He gave us he brought us the tools for survival throughout the long galus. That, of course, is the Torah HaKadosha. He kept Klal Yisrael on this planet when HaKadosh Baruch Hu was ready to wipe us out. He's the one that stood in the way and said, no, they have to make it. And throughout history, you know, I was reading last summer, the biography I was reading was Rav Shmuel Birnbaum's biography. Rav Shmuel Birnbaum was the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir in Brooklyn. He learned in Mir Shanghai, he learned in the Mir in Europe, and he was Rosh Yeshiva of Mir in Brooklyn. I once had the opportunity to introduce him for a shir that he gave in Lawrence. I was an assistant rabbi in a shul. The rabbi wasn't there that day, and it was like a legal holiday shir, and he gave shir. I introduced Rav Shmuel Birnbaum. I didn't know much about him, but everyone said there's only one thing to say about him. He's the masmid hador. He's the biggest masmid of the whole generation. He's constantly learning. If Rav Moshe was the posek hador, and this, you know, that one's the gadol hador, or the biggest gon, the biggest magid shir, whatever. He's the masmid hador. He's the greatest masmid anyone's ever seen. And when he was young, he lived in a small shtetl near Bialystok, where all of the children were abandoning any form of Talmud Torah before their bar mitzvah. We don't realize how grave the situation was in many parts of Europe in terms of Frumkeit prior to World War II, because we're always told of the romanticized version of history about how everyone was a gon and a tzaddik and everyone was so righteous and sincere. There were droves and droves of people at a very young age that were giving up any form of Talmud Torah and often any form of Yiddishkeit. And there was a local Malami, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Rav Birchka, I don't know, who had a few conversations with little Shmuel Birnbaum about the importance of Torah, with a young Shmuel Birnbaum. And ultimately, he always attributed those conversations that he had with this Rav Birchka he always attributed his success and his desire to learn to those conversations. Like, that was his inspiration. That's the one who set him on his path. And it just pointed out in this biography that if you would have asked this Rav Birchka before he died, was he a success or failure as a mechanech, he would have told you abject failure, absolute failure. All of the kids that he was supposed to be teaching were going off the derech. No one was sticking around. He accomplished nothing. That's what he would have told you. That's what he would have felt. He would have felt like everything was mass defection of all of his students from Torah. But he had no idea that he had set the trajectory of the Masmid Hador of Rav Shmuel Birnbaum. He didn't even know his own successes. Very often it's hard to emphasize the success when we're not even aware of it. But we have to believe that if we're acting L'Shem Shemayim, we're doing our best, then even though sometimes our failures overwhelm us, we have to realize that Kodesh Baruch Hu setting us is going to allow us to be Matzliach in certain areas. And that's, I think, the message of Sefer Devarim, that there are going to be times that we're going to feel that Kol Darav Shelo Nivna Beis HaMikdash B'Yamav, Kilu Nechrav B'Yamav, that we've done nothing to bring ourselves closer to Geula. But we should take chizik in the realization that we likely have added a few bricks to the construction. That even though to this point, at least today, to this point, we do not yet have a Beis HaMikdash, and we certainly hope we still have a couple of days left before Tisha B'Av. We get a one-day extension this year, right? We certainly hope, although Rav Asher Weiss had a shir this week about if the Beis HaMikdash gets rebuilt between now and Shabbos, so which day is going to be a Yontif this year? Is it going to be Shabbos or is it going to be Sunday? It's cute. So we still have a day or two, whatever. But to this point, we haven't rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash. but we still have to believe that we've done something. We've done something to bring us along the path. You know, we often downplay our own significance. And we should realize that the time, just by virtue of the fact that we're living in this time that we're living in, it could be that we're more significant than we think. Rav Moshe Targin, last summer when he spoke here, told me that he was Menachem Avil Rabbanit Henkin after Rav Eitam Henkin was killed, and together with his wife, they were brutally murdered. And while he was there, while Rabbi Targin was there, a group of Nishmat girls came to be Menachem Avil. And Rabbanit Henkin said to them, "Girls, do you know how many Svarim there are in Tanakh?" That's a silly question. The girl said, "Of course, there are, you know, at the Chidon during Color War," Rabbi Razin asked, "name the Svarim of Tanakh," right? So one of the Mechanchim in camp told me that he mentioned the Sefer Amos to one kid. And the kid said, "Oh, Amot, I forgot about that one. Amot." It's not Sefer Amot, it's a Sabbath. But she said, "Girls, do you know how many Svarim there are in Tanakh?" And the girl said, "Yeah, of course, there are 24. And Rabbi Nit Henkin said, "No, there used to be 24. But we're living through the 25th book, because this is the final chapter of history." And she said, "My son and my daughter-in-law were not on this earth for very long, but they were important characters in the very last Sefer of Tanakh." Meaning, viewed in that way, I don't know if I would call it a Sefer of Tanakh, but viewed in that way, of the last chapter of the story of the Galus of the Jewish people. You know, the people who make up that last chapter can be very significant people. The people who generate the Zechuyos, L'nikra Dabar Al Hashem Gomra, those who complete the job, those are the ones who get the most credit for the job. That's something, that's significant. But I think there's a second theme, and a more powerful theme maybe even, in Moshe Rabbeinu's speech. See, toward the beginning of the speech, he recalls, "Ve'akach es rashei shifteichem, anashim chachamim viduim, ve'atein osam roshim aleichem." I've appointed people who are to positions of authority. "Va'atzaveh shifteichem beisi leimar shomo b'nechechem shvatem tzedek b'neishu b'nechir v'ben gero. Lo sakiru panu b'mishpat kakotan kagadol tishmu'un." Moshe's parting words to the Jewish people are that you always have to be committed to justice. The way Tzvi Hirschweiner phrases it in his Sefer HaChumash, the Jewish people have an obsession with justice and mercy. An obsession with justice and mercy. What do we do when terrible things happen and the world seems to be moving backward? You know, when most others would just lash out, knee-jerk reaction, anger, or yeyush, just totally give up. We do neither. Moshe teaches us, if there's darkness in the world, we bring more light into it. He teaches us that we look to promote justice and kindness in a world that seems to be increasingly unjust and unkind. That's our job. You know, last year, around this time, Marcus spoke about it the other day, there was a family in Eretz Yisrael, the Solomon family, celebrating a Shalom Zachar on a Friday night. And there was a knock at the door, and they answered the door, and they were all massacred. And the official reason, not all massacred, but there was a massacre. The official reason given for the barbarism at the time, I don't know if you guys remember, it was 1 year ago. What was the reason? Like, well, how does Hamas explain? Like, why would we knock on an innocent family's door and just, you know, murder people? And the reason was, and it was reported in the news, this was the official reason, because the Medina had set up, Medinat Israel had made the decision to set up metal detectors on Harabais. Now, I ask you, on what planet does that make sense? Because they said because we set up metal detectors on Harabais? So just absolute massacre? In what kind of world do people look at metal detectors for security versus senseless terror and murder of an innocent family celebrating a life cycle event and think that it's a worthy debate who the guilty party is? You know, like on all the news shows, they'll have two talking heads, you know, debating. Oh, who's more guilty over here? Whose fault is this? If you were to land from another planet and see that, you would assume, oh no, we must have bombed Mecca. I mean, that must be, you know, to get that kind of reaction. We must have just completely nuked Mecca. That's what you would have. No, metal detectors are in Harabais. We live in a very unjust world. So how do we react to a world that's so bereft of Geula? So if you ever had trouble focusing on Churban Habayis, you just look at the way these things are reported. You look at the world's attention on Harabayis and how senseless it is. So how do we react to it? Moshe Rabbeinu teaches us exactly what to do. And it's exactly, by the way, what the Solomon family did to pursue further justice and kindness. What did they do? They invited the entire country to the bris of the baby as Shiva was winding down. We see to it that we appreciate all of our fellow Jews. Now, I think I mentioned to you earlier, I think in the stats in the year 2016, maybe it was 2017, that of all the altruistic live kidney donations done in the United States, I'm a little into this topic now, my cousin just donated a kidney to someone this week, and her recipient happens to be the uncle of someone who dabbles in my shul, like total small Jewish world. So what's my cousin's story? Regular, healthy woman, and she decided she's got an extra one, so she'll share it. And so how often is that done in this country? Medina Shel Chesed, we call it, right? The United States of America. Well, of all of the altruistic means you don't know the person, you don't have any, you're not related to the person. Live kidney donations. Live meaning you don't have to die first to take the kidney, because you take kidney from a dead person, it works, but for only like 5, maybe 10 years. From a living person, more likely 20 years, 15, 20 years, so it lasts a lot longer. So, live kidney donations. What percentage were done by Orthodox Jews? I think in the year 2016, 2017, it was 15% were done by Orthodox Jews. When you take into account that Orthodox Jews make up less than 0.02% of the population of the United States, I mean, is there a greater statement? And by the way, the numbers are increasing, not decreasing. The percentages are increasing. Is it any wonder? You know, Ribon Shalom, we could say, Ribon Shalom, look at your children. This is who we are. This is what we do. So as we face the potential prospect of another Tisha B'Av, and we continue to reel from the pain of what all of the terrible things that are done to Achenu B'nai Yisrael, to Eretz Yisrael, and really throughout Europe and throughout the world, and we wonder in the back of our minds, another year went by. Have we gotten any closer to Geula? Have we, in our lifetime, seen, move the needle at all? So it's important to have Sefer, to have Parshas Devarim, Sefer Devarim, right before Tisha B'Av, to remind ourselves of Moshe Rabbeinu's message that yes, we are moving forward, yes, we are accomplishing, and will continue to accomplish as long as we pursue justice and kindness, as long as we are obsessed with justice and kindness. Why? Because that is who we are. And that ultimately is what's going to bring us to the final chapter of Jewish history, that 25th book of Tanakh, which we know has an incredibly, incredibly joyous conclusion.